From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Whippoorwills in the Hills by August Derleth. I took possession of my cousin Abel Harrop's house on the last day of April 1928, because it was plain by that time that the men from the sheriff's office at Aylesbury were either unable or unwilling to make any progress in explaining his disappearance, and I was determined, therefore, to carry on my own investigation. This was a matter of principle rather than of affection, for my cousin Abel had always been someone apart from the rest of the family. He had a reputation since his adolescence for being queer, and had never made any effort to visit the rest of us, or to invite our own visits. Nor was his plain house in a remote valley 7 miles off the Aylesbury Pike, out of Arkham, particularly a place to excite interest in most of us, who lived in Boston and Portland. I especially want this to be clear, since subsequent events make it imperative that no other motive be ascribed to my coming to stay in the house. My cousin Abel's home was, as I have said, very plain. It was built in the conventional fashion of New England houses, many of which can be seen in scores of villages throughout and even further south. It was a kind of rectangular house of 2 stories, with a stoop out back and a front porch set in one corner in order to complete the rectangle. This porch had at one time been efficiently screened, but there were now small tears in the screen, and it presented a general air of decay. However, the house itself, which was of wood, was neat enough. Its siding had been painted white less than a year ago, before my cousin's disappearance, and this coat of paint had worn well enough so that the house seemed quite new, as apart from the screened porch. There was a woodshed off to the right and a smokehouse near that. There was also an open well with a roof over it and a windlass with buckets on it. On the left there was another more serviceable pump and 2 smaller sheds. As my cousin did not farm, there was no place for animals. The interior of the house was in good condition. Clearly my cousin had always kept it well, though the furnishings were somewhat worn and faded, having been inherited from his parents, who had died 2 decades before. The lower floor consisted of a small confining kitchen which opened to the stoop out back, an old-fashioned parlor somewhat larger than most, and a room which had evidently once been a dining room, but which had been converted into a study by my cousin Abel, and was filled with books, on crude, homemade shelves, on boxes, chairs, a secretaire, and a table. There are even piles of them on the floor, and 1 book lay open on the table, just as it had lain when my cousin disappeared. They had told me at the courthouse in Aylesbury that nothing had been disturbed. The second story was a gable story. Its rooms all had sloping roofs, though there were 3 of them, all small, 2 of which were bedrooms, and the 3rd a storeroom. Each room had 1 gable window, no more. One of the bedrooms was over the kitchen, 1 over the parlor, and the storeroom was over the study. There was no reason to believe that my cousin Abel had occupied either of the bedrooms. However, indications were that he made use of a couch in the parlor, and since the couch was softer than usual, I determined to use it also. The stairway to the 2nd floor led up out of the kitchen, thereby contributing to the lack of room. The events of my cousin's disappearance were very simple, as any reader who may remember the spare newspaper accounts can testify. He had last been seen in Aylesbury early in April. He had bought 5 pounds of coffee, 10 pounds of sugar, some wire, and a large amount of netting. 4 days afterwards, on the 7th of April, a neighbor, passing by and failing to observe smoke coming from the chimney, went in, after some reluctance. My cousin apparently not been very well liked, having a surly nature, and his neighbors had kept away from him. But since the 7th was a cold day, Lem Giles had gone up to the door and rapped. When there was no answer, he pushed on the door. It was open, and he went in. He found the house deserted and cold, and a lamp, which had been used besides a book still open on the table, had plainly burned itself out. While Giles thought this was a curious state of affairs, he did not report it until 3 days after that, on the 10th, when he again passed by the house on his way to Aylesbury and, stopping for similar reason, found nothing altered in any way in the house. At that time, he spoke to a storekeeper in Aylesbury about it and was advised to report the matter to the sheriff's office. With great reluctance, he did so. A deputy sheriff drove out to my cousin's place and looked around. Since there had been a thaw, there was nothing to show footprints, the snow having been quickly melted away. And since a little of the coffee and sugar my cousin had bought had been used, it was assumed that he had vanished within a day or so of his visit to Aylesbury. There was some evidence, as there still was in a loose pile of netting in a rocking chair in one corner of the parlor, that my cousin was planning to do something with the netting he had bought. But since it was of the type used in seines along the coast at Kingsport for the purpose of catching rough fish, his intention was obscured in some mystery. The efforts of the sheriff's men from Aylesbury were, as I have hinted, only perfunctory. There was nothing to show that they were eager to investigate Abel's disappearance. Perhaps they were too readily discouraged by the reticence of his neighbors. I did not mean to be. If the reports of the sheriff's men were reliable, and I had no reason to believe they were not, then his neighbors had steadfastly avoided Abel, and even now, after his disappearance, when he was presumed dead, they were no more willing to speak of him than they had been to associate with him before. Indeed, I had tangible evidence of the neighbors' feeling before I had been even in my cousin's house a day. Though the house was not wired for electric lights, it was on a telephone line. When the telephone rang in mid-afternoon, less than 2 hours after my arrival at the house, I went over and took the receiver off the hook, forgetting that my cousin was on a party line. I had been slow to answer, and when I removed the receiver, someone was already talking. Even then, I would have replaced the receiver without more ado, had it not been for mention of my cousin's name. Being possessed of a natural share of curiosity, I stood still listening. "Somebody's come to Abe Harrop's house," came a woman's voice. "Lem come by there from town 10 minutes ago and seen it." 10 minutes, I thought. That would be Lem Giles' place, the nearest neighbor up the pocket and over the hill. "Oh, Miss Giles, you don't suppose he's come back?" "Hope the Lord he don't, but 'tain't him. Leastwise, Lem said it didn't look like him nohow. If he comes back, I want to get out of here. There's been enough goings on for a decent body. They ain't found hide nor hair of him. And they won't, neither. They got him. I'd knowed he was a-callin' 'em. Amos told him right off to get rid of them books, but he knowed better. A-sittin' there night after night, readin' in them devilish books. Don't you worry none, Hester. All these goings on, it's a God's mercy a body's alive to worry." This somewhat ambiguous conversation convinced me that the natives of this secluded pocket of hill country knew far more than they had told the men from the sheriff's office. But this initial conversation was only the beginning. Thereafter, the telephone rang at half-hour intervals. My arrival at my cousin's house was the principal topic of conversation. Thereafter, too, I listened shamelessly. The neighbors circling the pocket where the house stood numbered 7 families, none of which was inside of any part of my cousin's house. There was, in this order, up the pocket, Lem and Abby Giles and their 2 sons, Arthur and Albert, with 1 daughter, Virginia, a feeble-minded girl in her late 20s. Beyond them, well up into the next pocket, Lute and Jethro Corey, bachelors with a hired man, Curtis Begbie. East of them, deep in the hills, Seth Whiteley, his wife Emma, and their 3 children, Willie, Mamie, and Ella. Down from them and opposite my cousin's house, about a mile to the east, the Bon Ho, a widower, his children, Susie and Peter, and his sister Lavinia. About a half mile further down, along the road that led into the pocket, Clem Osborne and his wife Marie, with 2 hired men, John and Andrew Baxter. And finally, over the hills, west of my cousin's house, Rufus and Angeline Wheeler, with their sons Perry and Nathaniel, and the 3 spinster Hutchins sisters, Hester, Josephine, and Amelia, with 2 hired men, Jesse Trumbull and Amos Whateley. All these people were connected to the single party line, which included my cousin's telephone. In the course of 3 hours, what with one woman calling another back and forth without any end before supper time, everyone on the line had been informed of my coming, and, as each woman added her bit of information, each of the others learned who I was and correctly guessed my purpose. All this was perhaps natural enough in such an isolated neighborhood, where the most trivial event is a subject of deep concern to people who have little else to engage their attention. But what was disturbing about this fire of gossip on the party wire was the unmistakable undercurrent of fear which was omnipresent. Clearly my cousin Abel Harrop had been shunned for some reason connected with this incredible fear of him and whatever it was he was doing. It was sobering to reflect that out of such primitive fear could very easily rise the decision to kill in order to escape that fear. I knew it would be no easy task to break down the suspicious reserve of the neighbors, but I was determined that it must and would be done. I retired early that night, but I did not reckon with the difficulties of going to sleep in such an environment as my cousin's house. Where I had expected an unbroken silence, I found instead a maddening cacophony of sound which assaulted and engulfed the house. Beginning a half hour after sundown in mid-twilight, there was such a calling of whippoorwills as I have never heard before. Where one bird had called alone for 5 minutes or thereabouts, in 30 minutes there were 20 birds calling, and in an hour the number of whippoorwills seemed to have risen to well over 100. Moreover, the configuration of the pocket was such that the hills at one side threw back the echoes of sounds from the other, so that the voices of 100 birds soon assumed the proportions of 2, varying in intensity from a demanding scream rising with explosive force from just beyond my window to a faintly whispered call coming from far up or down the valley. Knowing a little of the habits of whippoorwills, I fully expected the calls to cease within an hour of beginning and to start up again just before dawn. In this, I was mistaken. Not only did the birds call incessantly all night long, but it was unmistakably evident that a large number of them flew in from the woods to sit on the roof of the house, as well as on the sheds and the ground around the house, making such a deafening racket that I was completely unable to sleep until dawn, when one by one they drifted away and were silent. I knew then that I could not long withstand this nerve-wracking cacophony of song. I had not slept an hour before I was awakened, still exhausted by the ringing of the telephone. I got up and took down the receiver, wondering what was wanted at this hour and who was calling. I muttered a sleepy, "Hello? Harrop?" "This is Dan Harrop," I said. "I've got something to tell you. Are you listening?" "Who is this?" I said. "Listen to me, Harrop. If you knows what's good for you, you'll get out of town. You're as fast as you can get." Before I could register my astonishment, the line went dead. I was still somewhat drowsy from lack of sleep. I stood for a moment, then hung up the receiver. A man's voice, gruff and old, certainly one of the neighbors. The telephone bell had rung as if it had been ground by someone on the line and not by the central. I was halfway back to my makeshift bed in the parlor when the telephone rang again. Though it was not my ring, I turned back to it at once. The hour was now 6:30, and the sun shone over the hill. It was Emma Whately calling Lavinia Ho.
"Vinny, did you hear him last night?"
"Land sakes, yes."
"Emma, do you suppose it means—"
"I don't know. It was something terrible the way they went on. Ain't heard nothing like it since Abel was out in the woods last summer. Kept Willie and Mamie awake all night. It scares me, Vinny."
"Me too. God, what if it starts again?"
"Hush up, Vinny. A body can't tell who's listening." The telephone rang throughout the morning, and this was the topic of conversation. It was soon borne in upon me that it was the whippoorwills and their frenetic calling in the night which had excited the neighbors. I had thought it annoying, but it had not occurred to me to think it unusual. However, judging by what I overheard, it was not only unusual, but ominous for the birds to call with such insistence. It was Hester Hutchins who put the superstitious fears of the neighbors into words when she told about the whippoorwills to a cousin who had telephoned from Dunwich, some miles to the north.
"The hills was a-talkin' again last night, Cousin Flora," she said in a kind of hushed but urgent voice. "Heard 'em all night long. Couldn't hardly sleep. Weren't nothing but whippoorwills. Hundreds and hundreds of 'em all night long. Come from Harrop's pocket. But they was so loud they might as well been on the porch rail. They're waiting to catch somebody's soul, just the way they was when Benji Wheeler died and Sister Ho and Curtis Begbie's wife, Annie. I know. They don't fool me none. Somebody's a-going to die, and soon, mark my words."
A strange superstition, surely, I thought. Nevertheless, that night, following a day too busy to permit my making inquiries of the neighbors, I set myself to listening for the whippoorwills. I sat in the darkness at the study window, but there was scarcely any need for light, for a moon but 3 days from the full shone into the valley and filled it with that green-white light, which is a peculiar property of moonlight. Long before darkness came into the valley, it had taken possession of the wooded hills enclosing it, and it was from the dark places in the woods that the first steady whippoorwill began to sound and recur. Previous to the voices of the whippoorwills, there had been strangely few of the customary evening songs of birds. Only a few night hawks had appeared against the evening sky to spiral upwards, crying shrilly, and plummet down in a breathtaking sky coast, making an odd zoom at the trough of the drive. But these were no longer visible or audible as darkness fell, and one after another the whippoorwills began to call. As darkness invaded the valley, the whippoorwills did likewise. Undeniably, the whippoorwills drifted down out of the hills on noiseless wings towards the house in which I sat. I saw the first one come, a dark object in the moonlight, to the roof of the woodshed. In a matter of moments, another bird followed, then another and another. Soon I saw them come to the ground between the sheds and the roof of the house, and I knew they were on the house itself. They occupied every roof, every fence post. I counted over 100 of them before I stopped counting, being unsure about their flight pattern since I observed some of them moving from one place to another. Never once did their calling cease. I used to think that the call of the whippoorwill was a sweetly nostalgic sound, but never again. Surrounding the house, the birds made the most hellish cacophony conceivable, whereas the call of a whippoorwill heard from a distance is mellow and pleasant. The same call heard just outside the window is unbelievably harsh and noisy, a cross between a scream and an angry rattle.
Multiplied by scores, the calls were truly maddening, grating on me to such an extent that after an hour of it, following the ordeal of the previous night, I took refuge in cotton stuffed into my ears. Even this afforded but temporary relief, but with its help and the exhaustion I felt after that the sleepless night just passed, I was able to sleep after a fashion. My last thought before sleep overcame me was that I must go on about my business without delay, lest I be driven out of my mind by the ceaseless insistence of the whippoorwills, which obviously meant to come down out of the hills every night in their season. I was awake before dawn. The soporific of sleep had worn off, but the whippoorwills had not ceased to call. I sat up on my couch and presently got up to look out the window. The birds were still there, though they had moved a little further away from the house now, and were no longer quite so numerous. A faint hint of dawn shone in the east, and there too, taking the place of the moon which had gone down, shone the morning stars. The planet Mars, already well up the eastern heaven, with Venus and Jupiter, less than 5 degrees above the eastern rim, and glowing with supernal splendor. I dressed myself, made some breakfast, and for the first time stopped to look at the books my cousin Abel had gathered together. I had given a cursory glance to the open book on the table, but it meant nothing to me since it appeared to be printed in a typeface which was an imitation of someone's script and was therefore scarcely legible. Moreover, it concerned alien matters, which seemed to me the various fancies of someone's drug-ridden mind. My cousin's other books, however, appeared to be of similar nature. A file of the old farmer's almanac stood out with welcome familiarity, but this alone was familiar. Though I was never a poorly read man, I confess to a feeling of utter strangeness before my cousin's library, if such it can be called. Yet a cursory examination of it filled me with a new respect for my cousin, for his ability certainly exceeded my own in the matter of languages. If he had been able to read all the tomes he had collected, for they were in several languages, as their titles indicated, and most of them had no meaning for me at all. I remembered having vaguely heard of the Reverend Ward Phillips' book, Thaumaturgical Prodigies in the New English Canon, but of such books as The Coast of Ghouls by Comte d'Erlet, De Vermis Mysterious by Dr. Ludwig Prynne, Lully's Ars Magna et Ultima, The Canonic Manuscripts, The Rilje Texts, Von Jungst, and many other similar titles I had never heard. It did not occur to me, frankly, that these books might contain a key to my cousin's disappearance, until later that day when finally I did take time to make some attempt to see the neighbors, for the purpose of making inquiry among them in the hope of accomplishing more than the men from the sheriff's office. I went first to the Giles place, which was approximately 1 mile up into the hills, directly south of my cousin's house. My reception was not encouraging. Abby Giles, a tall, gaunt woman, saw me from the window and, shaking her head, refused to come to the door. As I stood in the yard, wondering how I could convince her that I was not dangerous, Lem Giles came hurriedly from the barn. The belligerence of his gaze gave me pause. "What do you want in here, stranger?" he asked. Though he called me stranger, I felt that he knew me perfectly well. I introduced myself and explained that I was endeavoring to learn the truth about my cousin's disappearance. Could he tell me anything about Abel? "Can't tell you nothing," he said shortly. "Go ask the sheriff. I told him everything I got to say." "I think people hereabouts know more than they are saying," I said firmly. "Might be, but they ain't saying it, and that's a fact." More than this, I could not get out of Lem Giles. I went on to the Corey place, but no one was at home there. So I took a ridge path I was confident would lead me to the Hutchins place, as it did. But before I could get to the house, I was seen from one of the hill fields. Someone hailed me, and I found myself confronting a barrel-chested man. half a head taller than myself, who demanded truculently to know where I was going. "I'm on my way to Hutchins," I said. "No need you going then," he said. "They ain't to home. I work for 'em. Name's Amos Whately." But I had spoken to Amos Whately before. I recognized his voice as that of a man who early that morning told me to get out of there as fast as you can get. I looked at him for a minute in silence. "I'm Dan Harrop," I said finally. "I came up here to find out what happened to my cousin Abel, and I mean to find out." I could see that he had known who I was. He stood considering me for a moment before he spoke. "And if you find out, you'll go? I have no other reason for staying." He seemed indecisive still, as if he did not trust me. "You'll sell the house?" he wanted to know. "I can't use it." "I'll tell you then," he said with abrupt decision. "Your cousin, him as was Abel Harrop, was took off by them from outside. He called them and they come." He paused suddenly as he had begun to speak, his dark eyes searching my face. "You don't believe," he said. "You don't know?" "Know what?" I asked. "About them from outside." He looked distressed. "I hadn't to have told you then. You'll pay no mind to me." I tried to be patient and explained once more that I wanted only to know what had happened to Abel. But he was no longer interested in my cousin's fate. Still searching my face keenly, he demanded, "The books! Have you read the books?" I shook my head. "I tell you to burn 'em. Burn 'em all afore it's too late," he spoke with almost fanatic insistence. "I know what's in 'em, somewhat." It was a strange adjuration which ultimately sent me to the books my cousin had left. That evening I sat down at the table where my cousin must so often have sat by the light of the same lamp, with a chorus of whippoorwills already rising outside, to look with greater care at the book my cousin had been reading. I discovered almost at once, to my astonishment, that the print, which I had mistaken for an imitation of script, was indeed script, and I had further the uncomfortable conviction that the manuscript, which had no title, was bound in human skin. Certainly it was very old, and it had the appearance of having been put together of scattered sheets of paper on which its compiler had copied sentences and pages from books not his to own. Some of it was in Latin, some in French, some in English, though the writer's script was too execrable to permit any assurance in reading the Latin or French. I could make out the English after some study. Most of it was plainly gibberish, but there was two pages which my cousin, or some previous reader, had marked in red crayon, and these I deem must have been of some signal importance to Abel. I set about to make some sort of clarity out of the crab script. The first of them was fortunately short. "To summon Yog-Sothoth from the outside, be wise to wait upon the sun in the fifth house, when Saturn is in trine. Draw the pentagram of fire and speak the ninth verse thrice, repeating with each Rudimus and Hallows Eve causeth the thing to breed in the outside spaces beyond the gate of which Yog-Sothoth is the guardian. The once will not bring him, but may bring another who is likewise desirous of growth. And if he have not the blood of another, he may seek thine own. Therefore be not unwise in these things." To this my cousin had written a postscript. Cf. page 71 in text. Putting aside this reference, I turned to the other marked page. But no matter how carefully I read it, I could not make out of it anything but a highly fanciful rigmarole, evidently copied faithfully from a far older manuscript. "Concerning ye old ones, 'tis writ, they wait everywhere at gate at all times, for they know nothing of time or place, but are in all time and in all place, together without appearing to be, and there are those amongst them which can assume divers shapes and features, and any shape in any given face, and these gates are for them everywhere. But that which I caused to be opened, namely in Aram, city of pillars, and cities under the desert, but where men say the forbidden words, they shall cause there a gate to be established, and shall wait upon them who come through the gate, even as dolls and abominations might go, and Chocho people, and deep ones, and Gogs and Gaunts and Night, and Sogoths and Vormis and Shantax, which guard Kedath in the cold waste plateau land. All are alike children of the elder gods. But the great race of Yith and the old ones failed to agree one with another, and both with elder gods separating, leaving the old ones in possession of the earth, while their great race, returning from Yith, took up their abode forward in time in earthland not yet known to those who walk the earth today. And there wait till there shall come again the winds and thy voices which drove them forth before, and that which walketh on the winds over the earth and in the spaces that are among the stars forever. I read this with amazement and wonder, but since it meant nothing to me, I returned to the original marked page and attempted to puzzle meaning out of that. I could not, save that I had an uneasy memory of Amos Whately's reference to them outside. I guess finally that my cousin's appended note referred to the Riley text, so I took up the slender volume and looked to the indicated page. My language study was unfortunately not thorough enough to read the page with any sure meaning, but it appeared to be a formula or chant summoning some ancient being in which some primitive peoples had evidently once believed. I went through it uncertainly in silence. Then I read it slowly aloud, but it seemed to have no greater meaning audibly, except only as a curious aspect of ancient religious credos, for to such facets of existence I deemed it was related. By the time I rose wearily from the books, the whippoorwills had once again taken possession of the valley. I put out the light and looked into the moonlit darkness beyond the house. The birds were there. As before, they made dark shadows on the grass, on the roofs. In the moonlight, they had a strange appearance of being uncannily distorted, and they were certainly abnormally large birds. I had thought of whippoorwills as not more than 10 inches in length, but these birds were easily 12 and 14 inches long, and of an equivalent thickness, so that they appeared singularly large. Doubtless, however, this was due to some trick of moonlight and shadow, acting upon a tired and already overburdened imagination. But there was no gainsaying the fact that the vehemence and loudness of their calls was in ratio to their apparently abnormal size. There was considerably less movement among them that night, however, and I had an uneasy conviction that they sat there calling as if calling to someone or something, or as if waiting for something to happen, so that Hester Hutchins' hushed, urgent voice came back to my mind with disturbing persistence. They're waiting to catch somebody's soul. The strange events which subsequently took place at my cousin's house date from that night. Whatever it was that set it in motion, some malign force seemed to possess the entire valley. Sometime during the night I woke, convinced that something more than the ceaseless storming of the whippoorwills gave voice in the moonlit dark. I lay listening, almost instantly wide awake, listening for whatever it was, listening until the endless whippoorwill screaming from a thousand throats seemed to mark the very pulsing of my blood, the throbbing of the spheres. Then I heard it, and listened, and doubted the evidence of my own ears. A kind of chanting, rising momentarily to undulation, but certainly in a tongue I did not know. Even now I cannot describe it with any adequacy. Perhaps if one could imagine turning on several radio stations at once and listening to alien languages pouring forth from each one, hopelessly jumbled, it might establish a sort of parallel. Yet there seemed to be a kind of pattern, and try as I might, I could not disabuse myself of this notion. The gibberish I heard mingled uncannily with the crying of the whippoorwills. It reminded me of a litany, with the priest leading the recitative and the audience murmuring an answer. The sound came intermittently, an odd predominance of consonants, with bit and occasional vowel. The most intelligible sounds, which seemed to be repeated, were Yog Sothoth. These were given voice in a crescendo of sound bursting explosively at the last syllables, to which the whippoorwills responded in rhythmic song. It was not that they ceased crying, but only that when the other sounds came, the calling of the whippoorwills receded and faded as if into distance, then rushed forward and swelled out triumphantly in answer to the sounds in the night. Strange and terrible as these sounds were, however, their source was even more frightening, for they came from somewhere within the house, either from the rooms above or from those below, and with each moment that I listened, I became more and more convinced that the hideous gibberish I heard arose from somewhere within the room where I lay. It was as if the very walls pulsed with a sound, as if the entire house throbbed with this incredible mouthing, as if indeed my very being took part in this horror-fraught litany, not passively, but actively, even joyously. How long I lay there, virtually in a cataleptic state, I do not know. But eventually the invading sound ceased. I was briefly aware of what seemed to be earth-shaking steps moving into the heavens, accompanied by a vast fluttering as of whippoorwills rising from the roofs and the surrounding earth. Then I fell into a deep sleep from which I did not waken until midday. I rose with a clarity then, for I meant to pursue my inquiry among my other neighbors with as much dispatch as possible. But I had intended to look further into my cousin's books. Yet that noon, when I came into the study and approached the table, I closed the book he had been reading and threw it carelessly to one side. I did this in full awareness of what I was doing, and yet with the intention of reading in it as much as I could. But there was something else lurking on the edge of my consciousness, a stubborn, unreasonable assurance that I knew all that was in this book, all that was in the rest of them piled here and there, and more than that, much more. And even as I took in this conviction, there seemed to rise up from deep inside me, as if it were from an ancestral memory to which I knew no bridge, a towering awareness. And there crossed before my mind's eye vast and titanic heights and illimitable depths. And I saw great amorphous beings like the masses of protoplasmic jelly, thrusting forth tentacle-like appendages, standing on no known earth, but on a dark, forbidding ground devoid of vegetation, stuck out gigantically against no known stars. And in the inner ear, I heard names chanted and sung. Cthulhu, Yog-Sothoth, Hastur, Nyarlathotep, Shug-Niggurath, and many more. And I knew these for the ancient ones thrust forth by the elder gods, and waiting now at the gate to be summoned to their abode on earth as once in eons past, and all the pomp and glory of serving them was clear to me, and I knew they would come again to wage their battle for the earth and all the peoples of the earth, and once more tempt the wrath of the elder gods, even as the poor pitiable wretches of humankind tempted the wrath of their own fates. And I knew, as Abel knew, that their servants are the chosen ones, who shall worship them and give them shelter, who shall house them and feed them until the time of their coming again, when the gate is opened wide and 1,000 lesser gates are opened to them in all the places of the earth. But this vision came and faded like a flashing picture on a screen, from what source I could not tell. It was so brief, so momentary, that when it had passed, the sound of the books falling to the pile where I had thrown it still echoed in the room. I was shaken, for at one and the same time I knew my vision had no meaning, and yet I knew it did have an importance out of all proportion to this house, or this valley, or even to all the world I knew. I turned and went out of the house into the noonday sun, and under its beneficent rays, the dark ordeal passed from me. I looked back to the house. It shone white in the sun, with the shadows of an elm lying upon it. I went then into the southeast, striking off through the long, neglected fields and pastures towards the Whately house, which lay about a mile away in that direction. Seth Whately was a younger brother of Amos's. They had quarreled years before. I had been told in Aylesbury about what no one knew, and now seldom saw or spoke to each other, despite living but 2 miles apart. Amos had grown close to the Dunwich Whateleys, who were said the Aylesbury people, the decayed branch of one of the old Armigerous families of Massachusetts. The majority of the distance lay over the hill, through heavily wooded slopes and into the valley beyond, and quite often I started up whippoorwills, which flew on noiseless wings, circled a little, and settled horizontally on limbs, or on the ground, blending wonderfully well with bark or old leaves, gazing at me with their small black eyes. Here and there, too, I saw eggs lying among the leaves. The hills were alive with whippoorwills, but I did not need this evidence to know that. It seemed to me a singular thing, however, that they should be 10 times as numerous on the slope facing into Harrop's Valley than on those opposite. But they were, descending the slope through the aromatic May woods to the valley where the Whateleys lived. I frightened up only one bird, which vanished noiselessly, and did not move away only a little, and turned to regard me in passing. I did not think, then, that the curious attention of the whippoorwills on the near slope was frightening. I was apprehensive about my reception at the Whately house, and I soon found out that I had good reason to be, for I was met by Seth Whately carrying a gun and giving me a stony stare from above that weapon. "You got no call to bother us," he challenged as I approached. Evidently, he had just come from dinner, and had been on his way back to the field when he caught sight of me. He had then retreated into the house and got his gun. Behind him, I could see his wife, Emma, and their 3 children hanging onto her skirts, looking at me with fear plain in their eyes. "I don't mean to bother you, Mr. Whately," I said as reassuringly as I could, and with determined effort to suppress the irritation I felt at this unreasoning wall of suspicion which greeted me wherever I turned. "But I do mean to know what happened to my cousin Abel." He gave me his stony stare briefly before replying. "We don't know nothing. We ain't the kind to go prying round. What your cousin was a-doing was his own business, as long as he didn't bother us. Even if there's something better let alone," he added darkly. "Somebody must have made away with him, Mr. Whately."
"He was took. That's what they say my brother Amos says. He was took, body and soul, and if a man gets to look in where he hadn't oughta, that's what's a-goin' to happen every time. No man's hand was raised again him here, not but what there hadn't have been. I'm going to find out." He shifted his gun menacingly. "You can't do it here. I told you we don't know nothing, and we don't. I ain't meaning no offense, but the woman, she's upset as all get out, and I don't aim for her to be more turned out. So you get." However crude Seth Whately's invitation was, it was effective enough. But matters were very much the same at Hoe's, though there I was very poignantly aware of a greater tension in the atmosphere. Not alone fear, but hatred, too. They were more civil, but anxious to be rid of me, and when at last I took my leave, with no word of help from them in my quest, I was convinced that however they reasoned, the death of Laban Hoe's wife was laid at my cousin's door. It was not evident in what was said so much as in what was not said. The charge lay in the unspoken words lurking behind their eyes and tongues, and I knew, without needing to think further, but only by remembering how Hester Hutchins had talked to her cousin Flora about the whippoorwills calling for the souls of Benji Wheeler and Sister Ho and Annie Begbie, that the whippoorwills and my cousin Abel Harrop were linked in the primitive superstition which haunted the waking and sleeping hours of these remote and earthy people. But by what bond these events could be connected, I could not guess. It was patent, moreover, that these people looked upon me with the same fear and dislike, or loathing, as they had looked upon Abel. And whatever their reason for hating and fearing Abel had been, the same reason clearly applied to me in their limited capacity for thinking. Yet Abel, as I remembered him, had been even more sensitive than I, and though surly by nature, he had always been essentially gentle, unwilling to hurt anyone, least of all a fellow animal, human or otherwise. Doubtless their suspicions had taken rise in the well of dark superstition, which is always rife in isolated countrysides, ever lurking ready to spark another Salem terror, and hound to death helpless victims innocent of any crime but knowledge. It was that night, the night of the full moon, that the horror struck the pocket. But before I learned of what happened in the pocket that night, I went through an ordeal of my own. It began soon after I got home from my last visit, that afternoon, to the uncommunicative Osbornes, across the hills to the north, after the sun had vanished beyond the western ridge and I was at a meager supper. I began to have fancies again, and I couldn't get it out of my head that I wasn't alone in that house. So I left my supper and went through it, first downstairs and then taking the lamp, for the gable windows upstairs admitted little light. I went up. All the time I thought I could hear someone calling my name. Someone calling to me in Abel's voice, the way it used to sound when we were children and played together here at this place when his folks were living. I found something in the storeroom, something I could not explain. I found it by accident because I saw that one of the panes was out of the window. I had not noticed that before. The room was filled with boxes and a little discarded furniture. It was stacked neatly enough, and in such a way that the most light could still filter into the room from the one window. Seeing the break, I went over to the window, and when I came around the boxes stacked there, I saw that there was little space between the row of boxes and the window, enough for a chair and a man to sit in it. There was a chair there. There was no man, but there was some clothing that I knew for Abel's, and the way it lay there in the chair was enough to send a chill through me, though I don't know why I was so oddly frightened. The fact was, the clothes lay there in the most peculiar manner. It was not as if somebody had laid them down like that. I don't think anyone could lay clothing just that way. I looked and looked at it, and I could not explain it in any other way but that somebody had been sitting there and had just been pulled out of his clothes, as if he had been sucked out and the clothes just collapsed with nothing inside them. I put the lamp down and touched them. They were not dusty to any extent, so that meant they had not been there long. I wondered if the sheriff's men had seen them. Not that they could have made anything more out of them than I had. So I left them, undisturbed, meaning to notify the sheriff next morning. But what with one thing and another, and everything that happened in the pocket after that, I forgot about it. So the clothes are still there, sort of fallen together on the chair, just as I found them that night of the May full moon, before the window in the storeroom. And I set it down here and now, because it is evidence of what I claim, to stand against the terrible doubts that greet me on all sides. That night the whippoorwills called with maddening insistence. I heard them first while I was still in the storeroom. They had begun to call out of the darkly wooded slopes from which the sunlight had gone, but far down the west the sun had not set, and though the pocket was already in a kind of blue haze twilight, the sun still shone outside it, on the road connecting Arkham and Aylesbury. It was early for the whippoorwills, very early, earlier than they had ever called before,
irritated as I was already by the stupid superstitious fear which had repelled every advance I made during the day. I knew I could not stand yet another night of sleeplessness. But soon the cries and calls were everywhere. Whippoorwill, whippoorwill. Nothing but that monotonous screaming and screeching, the constant whippoorwill. It pressed down from the hills into the valley. It crowded out of the moonlit night, where the birds surrounded the house in a vast circle, until it seemed that the house itself echoed their cries, in a voice of its own, as if every joist and beam, every nail and stone, every board and shingle answered the thunder from outside, the horrible, the maddening whippoorwill, rising in a cacophonous quarry, which invaded and tore every fiber of my being. They made a wave of sound beating against the house, against the hills, once again as if they took part in some eldritch litany, and every cell in my body cried out in anguish at their noisome triumph. It was about 8 o'clock that evening when I knew I must do something. I had not brought any kind of weapon with me, and my cousin's shotgun had been impounded by the sheriff, and was still being held in the courthouse at Aylesbury. But I found a stout cudgel under the couch where I slept, evidently my cousin's, to be kept at hand in case he was awakened suddenly in the night, and I meant to go out and kill as many of the whippoorwills as I could in the hope that this would drive them away for good. I did not intend to go far, so I left the lamp burning in the study. At my first step outside the door, the whippoorwills fluttered up, fanning out and away from me, but all my pent-up irritation and wrath burst forth. I ran in among them, swinging wildly while they fluttered noiselessly up all around me, some of them silent now, but most of them still singing horribly. I pursued them out of the yard, up the road, into the woods, down across the road, back into the woods. I ran far, but how far I do not know. And I know that I killed many of them before I stumbled back to the house at last, exhausted, with only enough energy left to put out the lamp in the study, which had burned very low, and fall upon my couch. Before the distant whippoorwills which had escaped me could converge upon the house again, I was deep in slumber. Because I do not know what time it was when I came in, I cannot say how long I slept before the ringing of the telephone woke me. Though the sun was already up, the hour was but 5:30. As was now my habit, I went out into the kitchen, where the telephone was, and took down the receiver. That was how I learned about the coming of the horror. "Miss Wheeler? This is Emma Whately. You heard the news?" "No, Miss Whately, ain't heard a thing." "God, it's awful. It's Bert Giles. He's been killed. They found him just about midnight, there where the road goes across Giles Brook, near to the bridge. 'Twas Luke Corey found him, and they say he let out a yell that woke Lem Giles up, and the minute Lem heard Lute hollering, he knowed all right. His ma begged Bert not to go to Arkham, but he was bound and determined to go. You know how said all them Gileses. 'Pears he was a-going, and with them Baxter men works Osborne's farm, summit under 3 miles from Giles's, and he set out to walk to their place so he's could ride with them, wantin' no sign of what killed him. But Seth, who was down come sun up this morning, he says the ground's all tore up, like as if there was a fight, and he seen poor Bert, or what's left of him. God, Seth said his throat was all tore out and his wrist tore open and his clothes just about to shreds. And that ain't all, even if 'twas the worst. While Seth was a-standin' there, Curtis Begbie, he come running up and he said for O'Corey's cows, they had night pasturin' and that South 40 was killed too and all tore up, just like poor Bert." "God," whimpered Mrs. Wheeler, frightened. "Who will it be the next?" "Sheriff says, 'pears to be some wild animal. But there ain't no tracks they could see. They've been working all around ever since they got the word, and Seth, he says, they ain't found not much.
Oh, it wasn't when Abel was there. Isla said Abel wasn't the worst. I know some of Seth's kinfolk. That Wilbur and old Waitley. And they're a sight worse than a fellow like Abel Harrop was. I know it, Miss Wheeler. And there's others at Dunwich, too. The Waitleys ain't the only ones. If it ain't Abel. And Seth, he says during that time he was standing there looking at poor Bert Giles. Amos comes up. Amos that ain't said 10 words to Seth in 10 years. And he just took one look and he kind of muttered to himself. And Seth says he said, that damn fool spoke the words, just like that. And Seth, he turns to him and he says, what's that you're saying, Amos? And Amos, he looks at him and says, ain't nothing as bad as a fool what don't know what he's got. Then, Amos Waitley's Alice was a bad one, Miss Waitley, and that's a fact. And it don't make no difference, you're related. It's just the same. And nobody knows it better than I do, Miss Wheeler. By this time, other women had joined the conversation, identifying themselves. Mrs. Osborne came on the wire to say that the Baxters, tiring of waiting and thinking that Bert had changed his mind, had gone on to Arkham. They had come back about 11:30. Hester Hutchins predicted that this was only the beginning, Amos said it. Vinnie Ho cried hysterically that she was of a mind to take to children, her niece and nephew, and flee to Boston until the devil took a stand somewhere else. It was only when Hester Hutchins began to tell the rest of them, wildly, that Jesse Trumbull had come in and reported that all the blood had been sucked out of Bert Giles' body and also out of the 4 quarry cows that I hung up. I could recognize the beginning of the legend and the working of superstition beginning to be constructed on the few pertinent facts. Throughout the day there was various reports. At noon, the sheriff stopped in perfunctionarily to inquire whether I had heard anything in the night, but I replied that I was incapable of hearing anything but whippoorwills. Since everyone else to whom he had talked mentioned having heard the whippoorwills, he was not surprised. He volunteered the information that Jethro Corey had awakened in the night and had heard the cows bellowing, but before he could get dressed to go down, they had stopped. So he assumed they had been disturbed by some animal passing through the pasture. The hills abound in fox and raccoon, and had gone back to bed. Mamie Waitley had heard someone scream. She was sure that it was Bert, but since she reported it only after having heard all the details of the killing, it was thought that this was only an imaginative afterthought, a pathetic attempt to focus a little attention on herself. After the sheriff had gone, one of his deputies stopped in, too plainly worried because their failure to solve the mystery of my cousin's disappearance was already a blot on their record, and this new crime might well bring them further criticism. Apart from these visits and the steady ringing of the telephone, I was not disturbed throughout the day, and I managed to get a little sleep in anticipation of the night's infesting whippoorwills. Yet that night, curiously, the whippoorwills, for all their damnable calling, did me a good turn. I had gone to sleep, surprisingly, despite their cacophonous cries, and had slept perhaps 2 hours when I was awakened. I thought at first that dawn had come, but it had not, and then I realized that what had awakened me was the absence of the whippoorwills' voices. Their sudden cessation and the succeeding silence had startled me from my sleep. This curious and unprecedented occurrence fully aroused me. I got up, pulled on my trousers, and went to the window to look out. I saw a man running from the yard, a big man. I thought at once of what had happened to Albert Giles the night before, and a momentary fear took possession of me, for a big man could perhaps have wreaked the night's havoc, a big man and a homicidal maniac. But then I knew that there was only one man so big in all the valley, and that was Amos Waitley, and the direction which he was vanishing in the moonlight was that of the Hutchins place, where he worked. My impulse was to set out after him, to shout at him, was halted by what I then saw out of the corner of my eye, a sudden, fitful orange glow.
I threw up the window and craned out. Down along one corner, the house was burning. Because I acted without delay, and because a bucket of water already stood under the pump, I was able to put the fire out without the burning of more than a square foot or two of the siding and some further charring. But it was clear that the fire had been set, and undoubtedly by Amos Whately, and had it not been for the whippoorwill's strange silence, I might have perished in the Holocaust. As it was, I was badly shaken, for if my neighbors bore me such ill feeling as to take such measures to drive me from my cousin's house, what might I still expect of them? Yet opposition has always strengthened me, and after a few moments it was again true. I felt convinced anew that if it was my search for the facts behind my cousin's disappearance alarmed them to such a degree as this, then I was on the right track in believing that they knew far more about it than any of them was willing to tell. So I went back to bed determined to face Amos Whately next day, when I could find him somewhere in the fields, away from the Hutchins house, and we could talk without being overheard. Accordingly, in mid-morning I sought out Amos Whately. He was at work in the same hilltop field where he had worked when I first saw him, but this time he did not come to confront me. Instead, he stopped the horses and stood watching me. I saw as I came up towards the stone fence there that his bearded face held both apprehension and defiance. He stood unmoving, save that he pushed his crumpled felt hat further back on his head. His lips were pressed together in a firm, unyielding line, but his eyes were wary. Since he was not far from the fence, I stopped where I was along the wood's edge. "Whately, I saw you set fire to my house last night," I said. "Why?" There was no answer. "Come, come. I came up here to talk to you. I could just as easily go into Aylesbury and talk to the sheriff." "You read the books," he spat forth hoarsely. "I told you not to. You read that place out loud. I know you did. You opened the gate, and them from outside can come. Wouldn't like your cousin. He called them and they come, but he didn't know do what they wanted to, so they took him. But he didn't know. You daren't learn how to. And they're settin' right this mit in this valley, and nobody knows what'll happen next." It took me a few minutes to make sense out of this rigmarole, and even then it was only a sort of sense, not logical by any means. Amos apparently meant to suggest that by reading aloud a passage from the book my cousin had been reading, I had avoided some force or being from outside into the valley, doubtless an integral part of the native superstitions. "I haven't seen any strangers about," I said curtly. "You don't always see them," Cousin Wilbur says. "They can take any shape they like, and they can get inside you, and they can eat through your mouth and see through your eyes. And if you ain't got the protection, they can take you the way they took your cousin. You don't see them," he went on, his voice rising almost a scream, "because they're inside you this minute." I waited for his hysteria to diminish a little. "And what do they eat?" I asked quietly. "You know," he cried vehemently. "Blood and spirit. Blood to make them grow. Spirit to make them wise to humankind. Laugh if you wants to. But you ought to know. The Hipperhills knows all right. That's why they're allus singing and a-calling down by your place." I could not help smiling, though his earnestness was not to be questioned and forestalled the laughter he had thought was coming. "But that doesn't explain why you should try to burn my house down, and me too, for all I know. I didn't mean you no harm, but I wanted for you to get. If you ain't got no house, you can't stay." "And do you represent the opinion of all the others?" "I know the most," he said, with a faint pride showing through his defiant apprehension. "My grandpa had the books, and he told me lots. And Cousin Wilbur, he know too, and I know there's a lots of things that rest don't know about what goes on out there." He waved an arm towards the heavens. "Or down there, he pointed underfoot. "And lots they needn't to know, lessen it scare 'em. And only half knowing it was in nothing at all. You shouldn't have burnt them books, Mr. Harrop. I told you. It's too late now."
I searched his face in vain for any sign to show that he was serious, but he was wholly sincere, even a little regretful, as if he was sorry he had to consign me to whatever nameless fate he foresaw. For a moment I was uncertain as to how to deal with him. One cannot simply overlook an attempt to burn one's house down, and for all I knew, oneself with it.
"Very well, Amos. Whatever it is you know is your affair. But I know you set fire to my house, and I can't overlook that. I'll expect you to make that right. When you have the time, you can come down and repair it. If you do that, I'll not report you to the sheriff."
"Nothing else, either?"
"What else?"
"If you don't know..."
He shrugged. "I'll come soon as I'm able." However ridiculous his rigmarole had been, what he said did disconcert me, largely because there was a wild kind of logic to it. But then I reflected as I walked back through the woods to my cousin's home. There is a perverted kind of logic to all superstition, which explains the tenacity of superstitions from one generation to another. Yet there had also been an unmistakable fear in Amos Whately, a fear unaccountable except by superstition, for Whately was a powerful man who could in all probability have tossed me over the stone fence that separated us with a heave of one arm. And in Whately's attitude lay the undeniable germ of something profoundly disturbing. If only I could have access to the key. I come now to that portion of my account which must remain unfortunately obscure, for I cannot always be sure of the precise order or meaning of the events in which I took part. Disturbed as I was by Whately's rigmarole of superstitious fear, I went directly back to my cousin's house and turned to the strange old books which constituted his library. I sought some further clue to Whately's curious beliefs, and yet I had no sooner picked up one of the books than I was once again filled with the unshakable conviction that this search was futile, for what does it gain a man to read that which he already knows? And what they think who know nothing of these things, what do they matter? For it seemed as if I saw again that strange landscape, with its titanic and malformed beings. In it was as if I had heard again the chanting of alien names, hinting of terrible power. A chanting accompanied by a fluting of music, and a choral undulation from throats which were not human. This illusion lasted but momentarily, only long enough to deflect me from my purpose. I abandoned any further examination of my cousin's book, and after a light lunch I made another attempt to pursue my inquiry into my cousin's disappearance, with such lack of success that I gave it up in mid-afternoon and returned to the house, in an indecisive frame of mind, no longer so certain that the men from the sheriff's office had not done all in their power to trace Abel. And though my resolve was not diminished, I began for the first time to have grave doubts of my ability to carry on. That night I heard strange voices once again. Or perhaps I should not say strange, for I had heard them before. They were undefinable and alien, and once again their source was a mystery to me. But that night the whippoorwills were louder than ever before. Their cries rang piercingly in the house and in the pocket outside. The voices began, I should judge, at about 9 o'clock. It was a cloudy night with great gray banks pressing close upon the hills and the valley, and the air was moist. Its very moisture, however, increased the loudness of the whippoorwills and intensified the strange voices, which welled forth suddenly, without preamble as one before, outre, unintelligible, eldritch. They were all that and more, defying description. And once again there was the effect as if of a litany, with the chorus of whippoorwills swelling forth, as if in answer to every chanted sentence or phrase, an unbearable cacophony of noise that arose to frightful cataclysms of sound. For a while, I strove to make something out of the alien voices which throbbed in the room. But they were not coherent. They had the sound of gibberish, despite my inmost conviction that far from gibberish, they were significant and meaning far beyond my ability to grasp. Nor did I any longer much care from whence they came. I knew that they rose from somewhere within the house, but whether by virtue of some natural phenomenon or by some other agency, I could not determine. They were the product of darkness, or, and I could not gainsay the possibility, they might well have arisen in a consciousness deeply disturbed by the demonic crying of the whippoorwills, making their terrible bedlam on all sides, filling valley and house and mind with nothing but their thunder piercing and rasping, the constant shrilling whippoorwill. I lay in a state akin to catalepsy, listening. Yogg-Sothoth. The whippoorwills answered in a roly crescendo sound that flowed upon the house, broke against it, invaded it, and in the recession of voices, the echo came back from the hills, crashing upon my consciousness with only slightly diminished force. And again the explosion of sound, the incessant whippoorwill beating upon the night and the cloudy darkness like the throbbing of thousands upon thousands of wild drums. Mercifully, I lost consciousness. The human body and mind can tolerate only so much before oblivion comes, and with oblivion that night came a dream structure of unutterable power and terror. I dreamed I was in a far place, a place of vast monolithic buildings, inhabited not by men, but by beings apart from the wildest imagination of men, a land of great unknown tree firms, of calamites and sigillaria surrounding the fantastic buildings of that place, a fearsome forest of trees and other growths belonging to new known terrestrial place. Here and there rose colossi of black stone, deep in places where perpetual twilight held sway, and in some areas there was basaltic ruins of incredible age, and in such night-held places the constellations which shone forth resembled no known map of the heavens I had ever seen, nor did the topography of the land in those places bear any resemblances to anything I had known, save only certain artist conceptions of earth in prehistoric times, dating far beyond the Paleozoic period. Of the beings who inhabited the dream, I remember only that they were of no fixed shape, gigantic in size and possessed of appendages which were in the nature of tentacles, but afforded locomotion as well as the power to grasp and hold objects. And these appendages were capable of being retracted in one place and of coming forth in another. They were the inhabitants of the monolithic buildings, and many of them were inert with sleep, at which they were attended by fetal beings, considerably smaller in size, but of related structure, in that they too were capable of changing shape. They were of a horrid fungoid color, not flesh-colored at all. In this they resembled the color of many of the buildings, and at times they appeared to alter horribly in shape, as if in caricature of the curvilinear types of masonry so prevalent in various parts of that dream world. Strangely, the chanting and the crying of the whippoorwills continued as an integral part of the dream, but in perspective, rising and falling in the background as in the distance, and it seemed, moreover, as if I too existed in that strange place, but on a different plane, as if I too served one of the great ones there, going forth into the fearsome darkness of the alien force to slaughter beasts and open their veins so that the great ones might feed and grow in other dimensions but that of their weird world. How long the dream lasted, I could not say. I slept all night and yet was tired out of all proportion when I woke, as if I had worked most of the night and got but little sleep. I dragged myself wearily to the kitchen and fried myself some bacon and eggs, after which I sat listlessly to eat them. However, breakfast with several cups of black coffee gave me new life, and I rose from the table feeling refreshed. While I was outside for wood, the telephone rang. It was Ho's ring, but I hurried in to listen. I recognized Hester Hutchins' voice at once, having become accustomed to her ever-wagging tongue. "And they do say as there was 6-7 kilt. The best cows in his herd," Mr. Osborne said. "They was up in that South 40. That's his nearest pasture to Harrop's Pocket. God knows how many others would have been kilt if it weren't for the rest of the herd busting down the fence and getting down to the barn. That's how come Osborne's hired man, Andy Baxter, went up to the pasture with the lantern and see him, just like them quarry cows. And poor Bert Giles. Throats all tore out, and them poor beast beat up, southern terrible. God knows what's loose in the pocket. Vinnie's, but southern's got to be done. We'll all be killed. I know them whippoorwills was a-callin' for somebody's soul, and they got poor Bert's. They're still a-callin', and I know what that means. And you do too, Vinnie, ho. They's to be more souls a-comin' to them whippoorwills afore the moon changes want more. God of mercy, I'm going straight to Boston soon as I can get away. I knew the sheriff would stop in again that day, and I was ready for him when he came. I had heard nothing. I explained that I had been exhausted the night before, but had managed to sleep in spite of the din made by the whippoorwills. In turn, he very considerately told me that he had been done to Osborne's cows. 7 of them had been slaughtered, he said, and there was something very strange about it, for no cow had bled very much, despite the way in which each throat was ripped, and in spite of the bestial manner of the attack, it seemed plain that it had been done by a man, for there were fragmentary footprints and evidence, unfortunately not complete, enough to warrant attempting to make any kind of observation. However, he went on in confidence, one of his men had had his eye on Amos Whateley for some time. Amos had been making very queer remarks, and his actions had been those of a man who expected that he was being followed or something. The sheriff said this wearily, for he was tired, having been up since he had been called to Osborne's farm. "And what did I know about Whateley's?" he went on. I shook my head and confessed that I knew all too little about any of my neighbors. "But I've noticed his queer talk," I admitted. "Whenever I've talked with him, he said very strange things." The sheriff leaned forward eagerly. "Did he ever talk or mutter about feeding someone something?" I admitted that Amos had so talked. The sheriff seemed satisfied. He took his leave after indirectly scoring me for my own conspicuous lack of success in discovering what had happened to my cousin Abel. I was not unduly surprised at his suspicions of Amos Whateley. And yet there was something in sharp conflict with the sheriff's theory, deep in my own awareness, and a kind of uneasiness burgeoned there, like the nagging memory of something left undone. My exhaustion did not leave me during the day, and I did little work, though I found it necessary to wash some of my clothing, which had somehow become rust-stained. I took time to examine my cousin's work on the fish netting, and it occurred to me that he had designed it to catch something, and what more likely than that it was the whippoorwills, which must have driven him too to his wit's end now and then. Or perhaps he knew more of their habits than I did, and perhaps he had a better reason to try to catch them than their constant crying. I slept when I could during the day, though from time to time I listened to the current of frightened talk that went on over the telephone. There was no end to it. The telephone rang all day long, and sometimes the men talked to each other, as well as the women who had heretofore monopolized the wires. They talked about pooling herds of cows and setting a watch on them, but then, fearful, none wanted to watch alone. They spoke of keeping their cows in the barns at night, and I gathered that they had decided to do this. The women, however, wanted no one to go out after dark for any reason whatsoever. "It don't come by day," Emma Whateley insisted to Marie Osborne. "Ain't never been nothing done by day. So I say a body should stay close to home once the sun gets down over the hills." Lavinia Ho had taken off for Boston
just as she said she would, with the children. "Up and took them kids, and let Laban be thar," said Hester Hutchins. "But he ain't alone. He's fetched a man out from Arkham to set with him. Oh, it's a terrible thing. It's God's punishment on us. And the worst is nothing nobody knows what it looks like nor where it comes from, or nothing. The superstitions about the cows being drained of blood were repeated again. They said them cows didn't bleed much, and that's why. They didn't have no blood left to bleed," said Angeline Wheeler. "God, what's going to happen to us all? We can't just sit here and wait till we all killed." This frightened conversation was sort of whistling in the dark. The telephones gave them, men as well as women, a sense of being less isolated, less solitary. That none of them ever called me, I did not ponder. I was an outsider, and people from outside are seldom taken into country circles like that of my neighbors around Harrop's Pocket, in short of 10 years' time, if then. Towards evening, I was no longer listened on the phone, being still very tired. On the next night, but one of the voices came again, and the dream came too. Once more, I was in a vast place of strange basalt buildings and fearsome forest growths, and I knew that in that place I was a chosen one, proud to serve the ancient ones, belonging to that greatest of all, who was like the others and yet unlike them, that one among them who alone could take the form of a congeries of shining globes, the guardian of the threshold, the keeper of the gate, great Yog-Sothoth, biding his time to return to his one-time terrestrial plane where I must continue to serve him. Oh, the wonder and the terror! Oh, the eternal bliss! And I heard the whippoorwills crying, their voices rising and falling in the background of that place, while the chanters cried out under the alien stars, under the alien heavens, into the gulfs and to the shrouded peaks, cried out loud, Yog-Sothoth. And I too raise my voice in praise of him, the lurker at the threshold, Yog-Sothoth. That is what they say I was screaming when they found me crouching beside the body of poor Amelia Hutchins, tearing at her throat. The helpless woman struck down on her way back along the ridge path from a visit to Abbey Giles. That is what they say I mouthed in my bestial rage, with the whippoorwills all around, crying and screaming in their maddening voices. And that is why they've locked me into this room with the bars at the window. Oh, the fools, the fools! Having failed once with Abel, they grasp at stars. How can they think to keep one of the chosen ones from them? What are bars to them? But they are trying to frighten me when they say I have done these things. I never raised my hand against any human being. I have told them how it was, if only they would see. I told them. It was not I. Never. No, I know who it was. I think I have always known. And if they look, they will find proof. It was the whippoorwills. The incessantly calling whippoorwills. The damnable, lurking whippoorwills. Waiting out there. The whippoorwills. The whippoorwills in the hills.